Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name is Suzanne Youngerman, and I'm Director of the Department of Education and Humanities here at BAM that helps to organize this series of Eat, Drink, and Be Literary. And it's my pleasure to welcome all of you on behalf of Karen Brooks Hopkins, the President of BAM, Joseph Melillo, the Executive Producer of BAM, our partners, the National Book Awards, our sponsors, and all of the staff at BAM to tonight's Eat, Drink, and Be Literary. Please join me in thanking our really fabulous musicians tonight. They're from Juilliard, pianist Evan Schinner, and cellist Gal Niska. And we're really, really appreciative for their excellent musicianship. We're also delighted to be able to thank and welcome some of our valued sponsors tonight. We appreciate Bloomberg's generosity, loyalty, and support as the 2009 spring season sponsor, as well as the presenting sponsor of Eat, Drink, and Be Literary series. They've been an amazing BAM supporter for many years, and we're truly grateful for their support and interest in this series in particular. The New York Times Community Affairs Department, who is the Eat, Drink, and Be Literary media sponsor. I'd like to thank Diane McNulty and the other staff of the New York Times for their support of this series, and also for their generosity in donating next Sunday's book review, which is on the table out here. You're welcome to grab a copy on your way out and be the first on your block to read the Sunday book review. I also wish to thank Joseph and Diane Steinberg and Pine Ridge Wineries. They're sponsor of Eat, Drink, and Be Literary and a featured wine of BAM Cafe. And some of us come here to hear the author, but some of us come here for the Pine Ridge wine. So they always make the evening that much more pleasurable. So wish to thank Joe and Diane for their generosity. Eat, Drink, and Be Literary also receives support from the Axe Houghton Foundation and public funding for the New York State Council on the Arts. I also want to thank our in-house caterer, Great Performances, for another wonderful meal. And I also want to call your attention to the postcard that is in most of your programs. That's our junior version of Eat, Drink, and Be Literary, the BAM Family Book Brunch, coming up on April 25th with featured author Gail Carson Levine, the acclaimed Newbery Honor Award winner for Ella Enchanted. She's going to be reading and discussing from her book Writing Magic, Creating Stories That Fly, which is a how-to writing manual for children, and also her award-winning book, Dave at Night. Note that the final two events for this season's Eat, Drink, and Be Literary are sold out, but tickets do become often available on the week of the event, so if you missed out, you maybe get lucky and get one a day or two before the event. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce our partner, Harold Augenbraum, the Executive Director of the National Book Awards, who will say a little bit about the program and how things will work tonight. So, Harold.
I love it. You know, it's they don't usually raise the microphone for me, so thank you. Now, if you could just turn the lights off so it doesn't shine off my head. I'm here to welcome you on behalf of the National Book Awards, and I'm going to do a little bit of plug for the National Book Awards tonight. Instead of telling you about my childhood in Brooklyn, which is one of the things I usually do, or I give a little political talk, or sometimes I talk about literature. So this time I'm going to talk a little bit about the National Book Awards. The National Book Awards, this is our 60th year. So we've been around for a long time. On Monday, if you're going to be in Chicago, if you happen to be in Chicago on Monday, If you happen to be in Chicago on Monday, we're going to be kicking off the celebration of the 60th National Book Awards with a tribute to Nelson Algren, whose centennial it is this year, and who won the first National Book Award in fiction. And we'll be doing that with Don DeLillo and Russell Banks and Willem Dafoe and all the people in Chicago that will be there. So For those of you who are Nelson Algren fans, we'd love to see you there. Also on July 1st, yours truly will start blogging about the 77 National Book Awards in fiction between 1950 and 2008. Now, they're not 77 years between those times, but we had multiple categories. So if you click on, if you go to www.nationalbook.org on July 1st, you will see blogs about each book once a day for 77 days. I will also be tweeting about those books. So you'll be getting a tweet and a blog, and which is great because those are words that didn't even exist 5 years ago, but I will be doing them. We will also be doing a panel discussion on John Cheever to celebrate John Cheever at Madison Square during the summer. So look on our website. You'll be able to get the date on that. No tweets, no blogs. So how the evening will go. When I will introduce our moderator for this evening, she will then come up here and introduce our speaker for this evening. The speaker will read for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then they will go off. The technical personnel at BAM will fix the stage. They will have a conversation between the two of them for about 15 minutes. Then we'll open it up to the audience. That's when you ask your questions. After that, Ms. Greer will be signing books in the back. So let me get to the introductions for the evening. We generally have, as those of you who have been here before, we generally have two moderators during the 7 or 8 or 9 programs that we do. But we thought that this was going to be quite a special evening. And when we asked Germaine Greer to participate, we knew we needed somebody special to do the interview, and that's what I think we have. Katha Pollitt is best known for her Subject to Debate column in The Nation. She's also published in many other magazines, journals, and newspapers, including The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, Ms., and The New York Times. She's the author of the essay collections Reasonable Creatures, Essays on Women and Feminism, and, of course, Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. She won a National Book Critics Circle Award for a volume of her poetry, An Arctic Traveler, in 1983. In 2006, she published her most recent work, Virginity or Death and Other Social and Political Issues of Our Time. You have to read the book to understand what the title is, but it's really a great book. And I think one of the things about it is when you read her essays is they're quite extraordinary in that some people write essays and you get the feeling that the essays have a lot of feeling in them. And other people write essays, and you get the feeling that a lot of thought went into them. There's a lot of thinking going on. But when you read Katha's essays, it's really interesting that you seem to get both. There's both thinking and feeling at the same time. And it creates a sort of roundness to these essays that make them quite interesting and quite extraordinary, I think, in what what's out there today. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Katha Pollitt.
Thank you so much for those kind words. I just want to mention I have an even more recent book than that, which hasn't hit the remainder tables yet. It's called Learning to Drive, and it's a collection of personal essays. It's a little hard to... How can I do this? Okay, I'll stand back here. There are books whose message is so powerful, they change people's lives overnight. Books so powerful, in fact, that they change the lives of people who haven't even read them, but only read about them, or heard other people talking about them, or seen the author interviewed on television. Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was one such book, and so was Germaine Greer's The Female Eunuch, which came out 7 years later in 1970. In their different ways, both books threw a match into the pile of moldy old logs and newspapers that was the conventional understanding of how women should live. But of the two, in some way, Greer's book laid down the bigger challenge. Friedan told women there was more to life than keeping house in the suburbs. Greer told women just how much more life there was, how much they were missing by arranging their lives around men, marriage, and domesticity. There was sex, adventure, fun, and their own real, unshaven, undyed, de-lipsticked, de-false-eyelashed, undieted selves. Security, she wrote, is the denial of life. Take that. Germaine Greer was not alone in saying those things. Second wave feminism was not at all the starchy puritanical proposition some imagine it to have been, but she said it best, with the most passion and wit and poetry. Fortunately for us, Germaine Greer has gone on to write many other books, more books about women and sexuality, a book about women artists, plus a whole separate career's worth of scholarly books about 17th century poetry. And let's not forget a regular stream of stylish, sometimes ferocious, and always controversial commentary in the British press. Perhaps there are several writers all publishing as Germaine Greer. I don't know how she does it. And one of them writes marvelous things like this. If a woman never lets herself go, how will she ever know how far she might have got? If she never takes off her high-heeled shoes, how will she ever know how far she could walk or how fast she could run? And another Germaine Greer writes equally marvelous but very different things like this. Libraries are reservoirs of strength, grace, and wit, reminders of order, calm, and continuity, lakes of mental energy, neither warm nor cold, light nor dark. The pleasure they give is steady, unorgastic, reliable, deep, and long-lasting. In any library in the world, I am at home, unselfconscious, still, and absorbed. Of course, the woman racing barefoot toward her destiny and the scholar absorbed in the library are the same person, the whole woman, to borrow the title of one of her books. Her latest book, Shakespeare's Wife, unites the acerbic wit and freewheeling originality of the feminist with the quiet relentlessness of a scholar at the top of her form. It's a great privilege to introduce Germaine Greer here tonight.
Thank you so much for that. I really don't think that I deserved it. It's what happens when a really good writer gets hold of another writer and decides to make her sound better than she really is. I've written about as much bad stuff as anybody else, and I probably had less reason than most people because I probably didn't get paid as much as some of the people who write real rubbish. I tell you something tonight. I don't usually read to an audience because I think it's a cop-out. When you've written a text, it's meant to be read, it's meant to be communed with the single reader in the quiet of their wherever they choose to read, the train, the toilet, wherever. But I'm going to read tonight because I'm not talking to you for very long, and I'm afraid that I will start so many hairs that we will just end up horribly confused. So for the very first time, I'm going to read from this book. And I'm going to start at the beginning, which seems really simple-minded. I could have read you my favorite chapter, which is the chapter on Anne Hathaway reading the sonnets. Whenever I read that chapter, my heart begins to pound just a little bit, and my throat begins to close up. So I decided it would be embarrassing if I tried to read that. So I'm going to read the introduction. Introduction. Considering the poor reputation of wives generally, in particular the wives of literary men, and the traditional disparagement of the wife of the man of the millennium. Now, you may not know that Shakespeare is the man of the millennium, but the British, faced with this big challenge, who was the man of the millennium, came up with Shakespeare, and I thought, a playwright? Really? There was no more useful man around than a playwright. But no, they decided he was the man of the millennium. Anyway. Anyone steeped in Western literary culture must wonder why any woman of spirit would want to be a wife. At best, a wife should be invisible, like the wives of nearly all the great authors schoolboys used to read at school. If Homer, Aesop, Plautus, Terence, Virgil, Horace, and Juvenal had wives, they've been obliterated from history. The wives who are remembered are those who are vilified, like Socrates' Xantippe and Aristotle's Phyllis. Until our own time, history focused on man the achiever. The higher the achiever, the more likely it was that the woman who slept in his bed would be judged unworthy of his company. Her husband's fans recoiled from the notion that she might have made a significant contribution towards his achievement of greatness. The possibility that a wife might have been closer to their idol than they were, understood him better than they ever could not be entertained. If Xantippe had never existed, bachelor dons would have had to invent her. Among the scant references to her is the story told in the Phaedo of how, when she came with Socrates' three sons to visit him, when Socrates had been sentenced to death for corrupting the youth of Athens and ordered to commit suicide by drinking hemlock, she so annoyed the great man with her lamentations that he sent her home again so that his last hours could be spent in rational discussion with his disciples. No historian has ever shown the slightest interest in what became of Xantippe and her three small children after Socrates' suicide. Such mundane matters are beneath the consideration of great men and their biographers. To protest that Socrates' chosen martyrdom brought catastrophe on the four innocent people who depended on him would be merely womanish. As Lisa Jardine pointed out in 1983, Renaissance scholars from Richard Hooker to Francis Bacon are credited with scolding wives. Society seems to find it irresistible to characterize the unworldliness of the male intellectual and academic in terms of his failure to control the women in his life. Well, now, Hooker and Bacon did rather well out of their wives, who were both wealthy. By 1588, when Richard Hooker married Jean Churchman, the Protestant reformers had all but succeeded in eliminating the Pauline notion of wedded life as inferior to virginity. Even so, the woman who bore Richard Hooker six children and brought him the financial security that made it possible for him to become the leading apologist of the Anglican Church is known to us only as a scold. Bacon was married in 1606, when he was 45, to a 14-year-old heiress called Alice Barnham, whom he had singled out for the purpose when she was only 11 years old. It was well known that Francis Bacon preferred boys to women and kept a series of young male menials for his pleasure. In the circumstances, the young Viscountess St. Albans could be thought to have had every right to behave badly. She seems to have endured her grotesque marriage without complaint until she became involved with John Underhill. A Mr. Underhill is listed in 1617 as a gentleman in waiting at York House, where Viscount St. Albans and his childless wife, no surprise there, his childless wife, lived in state. In 1625, when Bacon was revising his will, in which he left the princely sum of £200 to a young Welsh servingman called Francis Edney, he added a codicil, revoking his legacies to Alice for just and great causes and leaving her to her right only. In a pointed gesture, a mere fortnight after Bacon's death, Alice Bacon married John Underhill in a public ceremony in St. Martin's in the Fields. Of the miserable story of the marriage of a trusting child to a middle-aged pederast, all that has come down to us is Bacon's view of marriage. He that hath a wife and children hath given hostages to fortune, for they are impediments to great enterprises, either of virtue or of mischief. Some such idea lies behind the almost unconscious certainty shared by all male observers that if a man of genius is to realize his potential, he must put his wife away. Shakespeare could not have been great if he hadn't jettisoned his wife. But if he is to be great, she must be shown to have got her just deserts. Thomas More, writing in defense of his friend Byron's appalling treatment of his clever wife, is one of the first to decide on little or no evidence that Shakespeare hated his wife. By whatever, I should read this with an Irish accent because Thomas More is an Irish writer, by whatever austerity of temper or habits the poets Dante and Milton may have drawn upon themselves such a fate, it might be expected that at least the gentle Shakespeare would have stood exempt from the common calamity of his brethren. But among the very few facts of his life that have been transmitted to us, there is none more clearly proved than the unhappiness of his marriage. Now, there's no evidence that Dante's wife, Gemma Donati, who was better connected than he, made his life miserable. It's simply assumed that he would have been happier with his muse. Bice portinare, Beatrice, as if it were the job of a muse to run a household and produce children. Gemma bore Dante at least 4 children. We should not be surprised to find that neither she nor they inspired a single line of poetry. When Dante was exiled in 1302, his wife of 17 years chose to remain with her children in Florence. Milton's marital infelicity is legendary in every sense of the word. He was 34 when he married 17-year-old Mary Powell, a few weeks before the outbreak of the Civil War. His wife's family were royalists, and she judged it best to return to them until the future should be less uncertain. This perfectly sensible response to a confused and dangerous situation is supposed to have prompted Milton to write The Doctrine and Discipline of Divorce, his pamphlet, and therefore it's assumed that when Mary returned to the marital household in 1645, he wished she hadn't, and that their life together after was miserable. Whatever the case, conjugal relations were promptly resumed. Mary's first child was born in July the next year. A few days after bearing her 4th, in May 1652, she died. Milton's first experience of marriage was not so disastrous that he didn't contemplate a second. He was already losing his sight when he married Catherine Woodcock in November 1658, and 50 months later, she died in childbirth. So far, marriage to Milton would seem far more punishing for his wives than for him. Milton married a third time at the advanced age of 55 because he was in need of a live-in carer. The woman chosen for him by his doctor was a poor relation of his own, 24-year-old Elizabeth Minshall, who lived to spend the inheritance, which was her only reward, and probably inadequate to support her for the 53 years that remained of her life, after the poet's death in 1674. By doing the right thing, by remaining silent and invisible, Anne Shakespeare left a wife-shaped void in the biography of William Shakespeare, which later bardolaters filled up with their own speculations, most of which do neither them nor their hero any credit. Her name and approximate birth date are known from her tomb in Holy Trinity Church, Stratford. Shakespeare's first biographer, Nicholas Rowe, supplied her maiden surname, and there matters rested until 1790. Previous biographers had not worried much about the poet's conjugal relations, nor, when they did evince curiosity, this is my darling, this is Samuel Schoenbaum, the author of the only necessary and reliable biography of Shakespeare, which is the documentary Life of Shakespeare. Anything else is an elaboration. All you need to know is right there. And this is what he says. Nor, when they did evince curiosity, had they necessarily assumed his disaffection with Anne. In the modern Universal British Traveller, which antedates Malone's supplement by 1 year, the biography of Warwickshire confidently informs us that Shakespeare lived very happy with his wife, and after he made some money-minding horses, fetched her to London. We don't know if this is true, but we don't know if it's untrue either. We simply don't know. It was in 1790 that Edmund Malone published an observation originally made by William Olds in the margin of the entry on Shakespeare in his copy of Langbaine's Account of the English Dramatic Poets of 1691, that sonnets 92 and 93 seem to have been addressed by Shakespeare to his beautiful wife on some suspicion of her infidelity. She's either ugly and unfuckable, or she's beautiful and unfaithful. Those are the options, mates. William Olds, who was born in 1696, had no special knowledge. His impression was based simply on his reading of sonnets 92 to 5, which in the edition of 1640 bore the title Lover's Affection. Olds had as little reason to believe that Anne was beautiful as later commentators had to believe that she was plain. At this early stage, it looks as if Anne is being recruited into the ranks of the beautiful, faithless wives. The allegation of infidelity would be made again and again. But for later scholars, the mere fact of her being older than Shakespeare made her unattractive. Right, so now Cathy is going to...
Hey, can you hear us? Are we on? Good. I have a lot of questions.
I'll try and answer them really, really fast.
No, I want you to talk. I'm only going to ask you a few questions, but I tried to sort of cover some varied ground. I'm going to come back to your book at the end, so let's leave time for that. Okay, so the female unit came out in 1970. It made a huge stir. That same year, you were one of several feminists who debated Norman Mailer at Town Hall in Manhattan. It was a big world historical event. Looking back, what are your thoughts about that period in feminism and in your own life? How does it look to you now?
Well, my difficulty was, from the very beginning, when it came to the way I related to American feminism, is that I was never an equality feminist. So I was, in some ways, not opposed to now, but just running on a different tangent, listening to a different drummer. So people talking about let's get more women into Congress to me meant absolutely nothing, because Congress would still be the thing it was. And the women who would get in would be the women who towed the line, who would be obedient and predictable, and who would be, in a way, more masculine than the men they replaced. You just have to think about Margaret Thatcher, you know, who was repeatedly described as the only man in her cabinet, mainly because she was more ruthless than the men in her cabinet, who at least understood something about the culture of parliamentary life and gave each other access to the lawmaking machinery, whereas Thatcher, if you opposed her, just sidestepped you. Lots of her colleagues thought she was absolutely appalling. And I've just written a 4,000-word piece about her, and I think she was appalling too, I have to say. She was the first hedge fund manager, I'll tell you. So it was always a bit difficult for me, because what happened in the case of Mailer, I mean, it's now a matter of history. You can probably get on DVD Penny Baker's film of Town Bloody Hall. That's what was actually said and done. I had a big quarrel with Norman because he had put money into the production of the film and he had post-production control. And there was no way I was going to let Norman edit me, no way in the world. And he rang me up in the Chelsea. I used to hang out in the Chelsea in those days until there was just too much hair in the plug hole. And he rang me up and said, Germaine, did you think I was going to take advantage of you? Do you think I would do anything so picayune? And I said, yes, Norman, I do. And so the poor old Penny Baker's film was not released for ages. Then I rang Penny Baker up and said, listen, go for it. You've got my permission. I signed the release, because Diana Trilling had given a very mendacious account of what had really happened and put it all down to me flirting with Norman and nonsense of that sort. I did consider whether it might be a good idea to bed Norman Mailer, and I sort of decided against it. I thought, no one's ever ended up better off for going to bed with Norman Mailer, so. But for me it was difficult, because I was never optimistic about what could be done within the existing system. I always thought we needed to overthrow it. I was always an anarchist. I've been trying to find out how the anarchists got on in London during the G20 summit, because I know they will have done really neat things, really funny things. They didn't just bust the windows of the Royal Bank of Scotland, and I hope they enjoyed doing it, because you know, it has been a dreadful situation, what happened with that bank. But one of the things, I've been looking for their witty and funny statements and the cute things they do with the monuments in the street. And the only thing I can tell you about is that somebody was carrying a banner that said, resistance is fertile. That's the only joke I've been able to collect for you. But I'm hoping that some anarchist filmmakers are on the street and will come back with the real story of the opposition to the G20 summit.
Well, just to follow up on that a little bit, okay, so on the one hand we have Margaret Thatcher, and she's an example of a woman who comes up through we have the example of Margaret Thatcher. She comes up through the existing system. She's quite conservative. She has no interest in women, their rights, in making life better for anybody but, you know, her Tory friends. But there are feminism, that kind of equality feminism that let's get women their rightful share of what life has to offer, has had a lot of other effects. For example, lots more women are professors, lots more women are in a position to decide whether a book gets published. There are a lot of women in Congress now, although only 17%. And I think that there's a certain amount of studies that shows that when women become a certain percentage of the power structure, they do good things for women, that money starts going in different directions, that they don't have to just sort of kowtow to the existing power structure. Does that any of that resonate with you?
Of course it does, but I would utter a warning about that, that the corporate world will sooner change a woman into its own likeness than the woman will change the corporate world. The corporate world is intransigent. It's sclerotic. It doesn't know any other way to behave. It is, in my mind, the corporate world is a whole series of sort of falliform structures where you claw your way to the top with people clawing their way behind you, and there's only one way out, which is to fall all the way to the bottom. That it's a fundamentally savage and primitive way of organizing industrial relations and productive relations, and that we've got to somehow think of another paradigm. And that's one reason why, in a strange way, I'm kind of hopeful about the recession, because we seem to be going back to very primitive business models. We are going to go back to savings and loans banks, you know, where people take in money, lend money on collateral that is worth the money they're lending. They don't lend money they haven't got. I mean, it's like a dream, isn't it? It's like... It's like a return to the Garden of Eden after all this complex banking. And, you know, I look back to a situation like the Enron situation, which I take as the beginning of all of this. And who rang the bell in Enron? A woman did. Why? Because she remembered what she was taught as an accountant. And she said, you can't keep books this way. These books are fraudulent. They're a lie. But it took her 6 months. She was so frightened. And ultimately what happened? She was drummed out of the industry. She now does what I do. She's a lecturer. And everything continued virtually unshaken after that extraordinary revelation. And if you look back at the revelations of fraud and sharp practice in banking, they have continued at a fairly regular pace ever since. And yet somehow we're all amazed when the whole thing suddenly goes arse up. I don't think we ought to be amazed. The whole business for me is that we have to rethink all these relationships. I mean, if you look at why organized labor collapsed, one of its reasons, one of the causes of its collapse, was that it did not unionize enough women and it didn't unionize enough people in the service industries, so that there was always this huge lake of unorganized labor that was ready to step into the breach when really unscrupulous bosses pushed over the unions. The unions were corrupt and self-serving. It's as much the failure of the right, of the left rather, as it is the criminality of the right that has got us to where we are. We have to start all over again, think in a different way. But I think, for me, I mean, what they're saying now is that the banks that didn't take risks, the banks that went quietly, the banks that were realistic about their future options, were the banks where women were best represented in middle and upper management.
Well, you know, this is an interesting thing because they're always saying, oh, yeah, women don't take risks, men are the big, bold risk takers. But look where that big, bold risk taking got us. I mean, what's wrong with not taking risks with other people's money? I completely agree with you.
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all, except that we do know that for women, the corporate world is miserable. It's miserable. First of all, women like the work they do. They like to deal with people. They like to be hands-on. They keep being told, even Mrs. Thatcher, this is true of, they keep being told, no, 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 delegate, delegate, delegate. Don't do the work yourself, delegate. And then if your delegate screws up, drop him, her, let them go. Women are bad at this. They give a job to somebody to do. They're anxious to show that it was a good choice, that they haven't overburdened this person. So what generally happens is you end up with two people doing the job. You've got the woman who delegated it and the person she delegated it to. And everyone goes, oh, these bloody women, they just don't know when to stop working. Damn right. You know, women have no notion what leisure is. They don't do business on the golf course because no one wants to see them on the damn golf course. They don't, I mean, why do 3 million British men go fishing? It's because women are not on the riverbank. That's why they're there.
Okay.
So I think we've really got to think about this. You know, I want to see women thinking of different ways of doing business. And we know that they're out there. We know that women have started small businesses, small service-oriented businesses, usually within their own community. But the thing that makes you tear your hair is that so many of them started those businesses on their credit cards because they didn't understand the basic rule. You don't lose your own money. Very simple. If I teach you nothing else tonight, remember, you don't lose your own money.
Okay. Well, moving on. Now we know how to start a small business. Okay, how not to start a small business. You've written one of your most incendiary remarks is that women have very little idea of how much men hate them. A lot has happened since you said that, and a lot of change, much of it due to the women's movement. So, do you think women have figured out that lots of men don't like us?
You know, that's not really what that's about.
Uh-huh.
What that statement is about is how many women think when they're being abused that is because somebody loves them. They can't figure out it's because they hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And it annoys me all the time that the police send me stuff about hate crimes. I look down the list of hate crimes, and wife murder isn't there. Two British women a week are murdered by mm-hmm. their partner. But somehow these are love crimes. They're not hate crimes. They're carried out because of jealousy or sexual inadequacy or drunkenness or for whatever reason, if you even want to use the word reason. Women tend to believe in the face of the most incontrovertible evidence that the man in their life loves them,
mm-hmm.
when in fact, if they looked at the bottom line, they would see that he hates them. And the thing is, of course, that love and hate at that level are indistinguishable. You know, jealousy crime, is that a love crime or a hate crime? I would say it's a hate crime, really. It's hard for women to believe that the man they love, the man who will repent, who will say, you know, I'm really sorry I broke your nose, give me another chance. They go on believing that he loves them. And I really want them to sniff the air and realize that living with that man is dangerous. You know, we are told all the time that women are afraid to go out. They're afraid to go on the streets at night. They're afraid to take public transport. And you want to say to them, listen, honey, women get killed at home. Don't be afraid of going out because the house you live in is the most dangerous environment you could be in. And that's simply a statistical fact.
You know, it's an interesting thing about Britain. I wonder if you can tell me something about that, that for all that we think of Britain as a liberal society and an enlightened society, their attitude towards crimes of violence against women is so terrible, and the rate of conviction for rape is staggeringly low. It's like less than 5%. Right now they're saying, oh, this is really great, we've improved, so now it's 5%, used to be 3%. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know enough about the situation here, so I don't know if it's markedly better.
It is better here, but it's not great, but it's a little better than that.
Well, what the police will tell you in England is that the workup of a rape case is very costly. Just doing the sort of basic stuff, the DNA and so on and so forth, is costly for them. That far too often the victim refuses ultimately to testify because she can't go through the ordeal of being in court. Most women we know are raped by people they know. Stranger rape is relatively rare. You have to be particularly disadvantaged to get done for rape in England, partly because, I mean, my view is that the law is impossible, that the law of rape is medieval. It is not the woman who brings the charge of rape. It is the people who own her, represented by the state. She is just a body of evidence. She is Exhibit A. What the lawyers have to do is challenge her veracity, destroy her believability in court, and they'll do that any way they can. Mm-hmm. In theory, it's impossible to bring character references and to talk about other boyfriends and da-di-da. We know, for example, that Helena Kennedy, Baroness Kennedy, brought a landmark case on behalf of two prostitutes who claimed they'd been raped because a client refused to use a condom. And the Crown Prosecution Service wouldn't take the case because given the current procedures, putting that through the courts mm-hmm. would have resulted in defeat. So Baroness Kennedy took a civil case against the client whose identity was known and won. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't changed anything. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed anything at all.
If I could just break in here, speaking of change, when I read the new preface to The Female Eunuch, it didn't seem like you saw a lot of progress between 1970 and 1992 when that was written. That you said, you know, now we've got women and they're athletes and they're doing all kinds of things, and, you know, prostitutes are writing their memoirs and organizing. But the idea that women see themselves through men's eyes, that that's the way to be, that women are organized around their appearance and around their sexuality, that hasn't changed. And you said wherever you see Coca-Cola and blue jeans and makeup, there is the female eunuch, you know, the sort of around the world. And I'm wondering, do you really take that despairing of you, of the change, the social change regarding the sexes? I mean, I'm much more optimistic.
No, you know, I'm not despairing at all because I don't think this was it. Mm-hmm. This is the prodromal period. This is where we're trying to figure out where it is we want to go and how we might get there. To my mind, it would be historically illiterate to say we thought of feminism in 1950 and look, it happened by 2010. That's not how major social changes happen. All kinds of other things have to change as well. And one of the things that's changing is, for example, that women's fertility is of less value than it was before. We've got too many babies rather than too few. We're anxious to somehow get the death rate and the death rate up because too many people live too long. It's that simple. We're not dying soon enough. You know, that's a tremendous weight on the planet. I know we don't like to think about it that way, but it's true. When people say to me, you know, what are you going to do for the planet? I say, well, die. Really? if I went on living till I was 120, this would be a massive calamity for the world.
I feel I'm getting some very disturbing advice here. Don't borrow on my credit card. Die. I mean,
borrow on your credit card.
Right,
trust me.
Right,
don't.
Okay, but
borrow on anything else, but not on your credit card.
But Germaine, life expectancy is going up, not down.
But don't you? Well, you see, that's not terribly good news. In terms of the planet, that's pretty bad news.
So maybe we should all start smoking again.
I don't know why they made us stop. You know. Okay. Because it did actually, I think if we did the right actuarial analysis, we'd see that smoking actually saves the state money. But they didn't. They did the sums the wrong way round. They talked about the people who are in hospital for smoking-related diseases. But they didn't talk about the amount of medical care that the people who died from smoking actually saved the state.
I'm being
mischievous about this.
I know.
But I really do think we need to think in a different way about where we're going. One of the shocking things for someone who comes from Europe to North America is that there is no sign in the massive conurbations I've been in now of anybody understanding what energy conservation really means. Jimmy. I have never seen anything so outrageously extravagant as, for example, coming along here, air conditioners sticking out of every window. Are we nuts? We can't do that anymore. It's that simple.
Germaine, I know people want to ask you many questions, so I have to break in here because we're on a sort of strict time schedule. So you
no,
have
we aren't. So, we can change that.
I think we can't, but
we can't change that. We can't change anything.
Okay, so don't put the cigarettes on your credit card because you'll be dead by the time the bill comes due. Jermaine, would you like to take questions?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The only one thing I always say. Oh, yes, ma'am. Stingray, yes.
Stingray, and we read your column in Australia about how you saw that occurrence. And I found it very interesting that you felt that it was an act on the behalf of the animal kingdom. I'm paraphrasing you, I don't know if I'm speaking. And I wonder if you could just, I don't know how many people in the States would have had any access to what you said, and if you could clarify that for me, or maybe talk about that a little. And does that fit in with how you want women's role to change? Also, a different view of how life is on the earth.
Okay, first of all...
Maybe you could repeat the question.
Well, I'm asked about Steve Irwin and whether what I said about Steve Irwin relates to how I feel about women and the planet and so forth. Now, if you really want to know what I said about Steve Irwin, you can probably find it online because it was published in The Guardian. And The Guardian has, I'm told, 1 million readers online in North America. What I actually said was that Steve Irwin was the wrong kind of naturalist. That what threatened species on Earth needed was space. And sticking your face in their face, humiliating them, frightening them, and making yourself seem like a big fella at their expense was just crap. It wasn't really where it was at. And that it was only a matter of time before Irwin did get his comeuppance. And it was ironic that he was actually killed by an animal that he and I both grew up with. In Port Phillip Bay, we have much bigger stingrays than the stingray that killed him off Port Douglas in Queensland. And he'd learnt to avoid them, as we all did as children. They're not going to chase you or anything. You just try not to step on them. And if you do, you generally get cut in the leg. And it's a nasty wound, and it's full of bacteria, and it takes a long time to heal. But in his case, he actually swam over the top of them, which was utterly foolhardy in shallow water. So the tail of the stingray caught him in the chest, went up inside his rib cage and killed him. You have no idea. The Australians went absolutely apeshit because I wasn't heartbroken that Steve Irwin was dead. What actually happened is The Guardian rang me up and said, "Have you heard that Steve Irwin's dead?" And I said, "Yes." They said, "Are you surprised?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Are you distraught?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Would you like to write about it?" So I wrote about it. But what happened after that, of course, is that the Australian naturalist community eventually put its head above the parapet and said, "Yes, this is the wrong kind of naturalism. We can't really..." Australia Zoo, for example, for me, is horrifying. I could never go there. The whole idea of animals being used for entertainment I find really crass and disgusting. And as for somebody showing his big cojones by riding astride a crocodile that is confused and disoriented and in captivity is... vile, in my idea, absurd, fake machismo. So the interesting thing is, and I've got to be careful here because the lady is litigious, but if you really want to know the outcome of all of this, just Google the name Terry Irwin, T-E-R-R-I, Irwin, and see what's happening to the zoo and to Steve's money, and to the nature reserve that is being set up in his memory, and to the Aboriginal people who can't understand why their land suddenly belongs to Steve Irwin, and the whole rest of it. It's a dog's dinner. And I don't go out of my way to talk about it. I didn't in the beginning. But it was really weird because there were death threats and there were boxes full of hate mail And all because Steve Irwin made a TV reputation for himself in the United States. He was never known before that.
Everything is our fault. It's just like, Obama said yesterday.
I don't think everything's your fault. It's just that if he'd been an Australian hero,
I could have
beaten him up with impunity.
Take another question before we have to stop.
Yes, ma'am. I'll make this really short. From the beginning, I have seen pacifism as a part of my feminism. I can't separate the two of them. I don't understand the push for war, because war doesn't answer any questions. It just raises a whole new set of questions. And we all know that wars end up with jaw, jaw, jaw. So let's start talking and skip the war bit. Now, most people don't realize Mrs. Thatcher's great triumph in the Falklands. More soldiers have committed suicide since the Falklands than were killed during the combat in the Falklands itself. And what I say is simply this, that war in the 21st century is unusable because the level of violence is more than anyone can cope with, including the perpetrators of that violence. Everybody involved is traumatized, and the damage just goes on for generations because the family relationships of these people are distorted. We have just got to be sure that war now doesn't make sense. And one of the things that makes me nervous about Obama is that they keep citing the Kennedy example, and Kennedy was a hawk, and Kennedy got us into a war that we could never have won and in fact didn't win. And I say we because I'm Australian and we were there. We are also in Iraq. Don't ask me why. It makes no sense at all. We've got about 18 combatants there and 400 officials, and Mr. Bush could never remember that we were there, and I'd be surprised if Barack even knows that we're there. It's really it's important that those of us who've got enough energy and gumption left just begin a groundswell that says, not in my name. We don't do this. It's stupid.
We have time for one more question.
Yes.
Desert Island, top 5 or 10 books, what would you take?
Oh, I'm so... I spend every penny I earn on rebuilding 125 acres of rainforest. That means there are books that I desperately need. I have to have all my floras. I have to have Rainforest Trees of Southeast Australia by Alec Floyd. I have to have The Flora of New South Wales by Gwen Harden, brilliant botanist, and a number of men I can't be bothered mentioning. And it would always... I'd probably take the Oxford English Dictionary because I can remember all my British history just by reading about words. Look up perambulator and you'll find out how we bred children for years and years. You know what I wouldn't take? I wouldn't take a single novel. I've never understood the point of novels. I read them and I think, yes, that was 3 hours pleasantly spent, and now... I have to learn something with everything that I read. So I would be fair. Would I take the Bible? Nah.
How about Shakespeare? Would you take him, or have you had your fun with him?
I think I can remember him. Pretty
good
much.
Answer. Uh-huh.
I might take Dante because I never had enough time.